Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who are these guys?
Yeah, what's great about this is that you can't even see it, and we're still doing the arm gestures with that. Welcome to Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmScoreRejects.com. David.Patrick.Kelly.
Are we going to just cover every fucking movie he's in?
If we don't, I'll consider this podcast a failure. I will write it down in my book as a failure of my life.
I think when all is said and done, this is going to be a David Patrick Kelly retrospective.
Yes.
That just took a very long way around doing it all.
Yes, yes, the Kelly spective. I am all about it. I mean, The Warriors, obviously. Commando, obviously. Fucking this movie, obviously.
Have we done Commando?
No,
I thought we hadn't
not.
Done Commando.
I'm saying by the end of time, by the end of this show.
I mean, we fucking did Dreamscape, motherfucker.
Dreamscape, motherfucker. John Wick?
Yeah.
Dude, okay. I know it's very early in the show. Sidebar.
Wait, you're going to a sidebar.
I know, before I've even said who we are.
You've done a business?
Yeah, sidebar before who we are. It's on a t-shirt. Don't
fuck
worry about it. Fuck it. Super Ninjas. I think what's awesome about revisiting John Wick, the original, the first John Wick, is that there's so many character actors in that movie that at one point they're just handing off to each other like it's a tag team match in the WWF.
Yeah.
Just like literally like David Patrick Kelly in, fucking Ian McShane in.
Yeah.
It's crazy. They're just like left and right. Like, oh, there's an amazing character actor. There's another amazing character actor.
Well,
it's nuts.
Here you had, I mean, that's a movie in which you had a stuntman who had gotten to the point where he was a stunt coordinator, and then he had gotten to the point where he wanted to direct a film. He was Keanu's stuntman for a long time. Keanu decided he'd do what he'd done for a lot of people, which is, I'm going to do you a favor, and I'll star in your movie. Yeah, we'll make another movie together. Let's do this. And it turned out he made one of the classics of this decade. Like, nobody, like, when we went into that movie at Fantastic Fest at the premiere, we had no idea. I was sitting on a fucking hardwood chair. We were all excited. It was just, we're watching a new Keanu movie. It's called John Wick, whatever. But Keanu's here. Let's fucking watch a badass fucking Keanu Reeves movie. It melted our brains, and we had no idea. Nobody knew that was coming. Even the company, you know, so many people have seen John Wick now.
Yeah.
It is a classic. Few of them saw it in a theater.
Oh, agree. Yeah, no,
absolutely. And that was one of those things. Is most people did not see that when it came out, and now it is one of the great, you know, action films of this decade. Like, it is going, when people talk about the teens 20, 30 years from now, they're going to talk about John Wick like it was some cultural fucking landmine that just went off, and like, oh my God, John Wick. But nobody's going to have stories about seeing it in a theater because nobody fucking did.
Yeah.
Nobody saw that thing coming, but it was so big. But it was one of those things where that guy made that movie as if nobody's ever going to let me make a movie again. So I'm just going to make my movie. I'm going to put some of my favorite character actors in it. You know, it'll fucking add some real fucking gravitas to this movie. And instead he ended up making something like that just is unreal. Like, just that it's like, how do you do that again? And
they did it twice. And the fucking trailer for the third one.
I have not watched the trailer. I don't need to watch the trailer. Oh, John Wick 3, am I there? Yes, I'm fucking there. Like,
absolutely.
Why would I watch a trailer for that?
I remember I got to interview Keanu for that premiere at Fantastic Fest, and it was kind of a round table, so it was like me and three other people, and somebody asked him about, you know, getting into that character, and he said something to the effect of, and I'm pretty sure these were the exact words because it sparked my response, is he said, I had to have a dialogue with myself about just being ruthless and, you know, not being a nice guy anymore. And I, without even thinking, said out loud, so would you call that my own private dialogue? And he was like, that's funny. And I was like, yay! Keanu Reeves appreciated a pun I made. And I just left.
By the way, Keanu Reeves has nothing to do with the movie we're talking about today, so let's get into the business.
Oh, right, yeah,
because I am excited.
Fire it up!
Fire it up!
Oh, yes, we are very excited about the movie we're covering today for so many reasons.
Many reasons.
I am Brian Salisbury. I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and colleague. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's a lieutenant of Megaforce. He's only a clown sometimes, but he's always a fun boy, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
I love that I, like, grandstand like a fucking carnival barker every time, and your response is always, yeah, that.
Hello, ladies.
As we continue through Patreon Request Month.
And God damn it, if you didn't request a movie that we've been wanting to do for a long time, that we should have done, that I am embarrassed we haven't done, that really is at the heart of everything that junk food cinema is about. Because here's a movie that doesn't get talked about as being one of the great films, that really is one of the great films of the 90s.
Agreed.
This is a film that has a lot of, it means a lot to me in my life. This is a film that it's one of the earliest films that I followed the production on, that I was reading about in magazines, that I was tracking. It was delayed because of the death of, Brandon Lee, the star of the movie, died while making the movie. It pushed off production. It looked like it was going to get tanked, that they were going to burn the film, that they weren't going to make it. They decided, fuck it, let's press forward. They made the film. They finished the film. I saw it in a theater, fucking fell in love with it, as many, many fucking people did in the 90s.
And which film is that, Cargill?
Well, we're talking about The Crow, which is listed on the podcast listing.
When I know, but if you don't say it, then I can't put in the trailer. So what movie are we talking about?
The Crow.
People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
You're all going to die.
Is that gasoline I smell?
Victims, aren't we all?
Why is Cargill going on like this? He loves every movie except The Perfect Weapon that they talk about. So this came out in 1994, late 94. Fell in love with it, bought it on fucking VHS as soon as Blockbuster had copies of it previously viewed. Like, of course, keep in mind. Hold on. Old Man Cargill, that old man Cargill. A lot of you won't really understand this concept because it's really fucking bizarre. But the reason why so many of us didn't own VHSs of a lot of our favorite films back in the 80s and early 90s was because they cost $90 a piece. Like, that was average for purchasing a VHS of something. That was the charge of what they charged the video stores for them. They didn't think that people would really want to own them, and only certain films would occasionally be released for an affordable price, where you could pay $20 or $30 and get a huge blockbuster film. But a film like The Crow was not that. And so what you would have to do is wait for that movie, because what they would do, the old release model was, you went to theaters, and then about 6 to 9 months after you were in theaters, you came out in video stores, depending on how big of a hit you were. And then about 6 months after that, 3 to 6 months after that, they could start selling
previously viewed. Copies.
And then 6 months after the release in video stores, bigger hits could be released for home purchase. Yeah. And that's where you would get occasionally big hits would cost $20 or $30.
Which is completely different from today, in which you can count and do this. I promise you it works every time. Count on your fingers 5 months to the day of the release of any movie in theaters. It's on video.
Yeah.
And now even sooner because of they'll release it sometimes on a streaming service first or on Redbox first, but every single time, 5 months, including the month of release, that movie will be on the shelves for you to buy.
So this is a movie that I was tracking. I was waiting for when it got dropped to previously viewed. It kept asking about it. Finally, the week I had heard from my video store, yeah, I think we're dropping in on Previously Viewed this week. I showed up 10 a.m., bought a copy of The Crow, and it was something that was watched in my apartment multiple times. Shortly thereafter, I met this incredibly attractive woman who, at the Rocky Horror Picture Show, who just kind of stole my heart, and we had a four-hour phone call, and in the course of that phone call, I discovered she had seen Pulp Fiction in a theater 12 times already. I had only seen it three. I threw Animaniac references at her. She threw them back at me. Like, this is a girl who spoke on my fucking wavelength.
I'm so sorry she dumped you, but Jess is a really nice girl, too.
No, she's my wife now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so while we were talking, I found out she had never seen Reservoir Dogs. I'm like, oh, well, I own Reservoir Dogs. You need to come over and check that out. And while we were talking, I also found out she hadn't seen The Crow. And I'm like, you have not seen The Crow. Oh, my God. You need to come watch it. And she's like, well, I've got nothing to do this Friday. And my first date with my wife was I cooked her dinner at my house and we sat down and watched The Crow. And that was my first date was in my shitty ass apartment in San Antonio with my wife, watching The Crow. And that is a movie that means a lot to me. And in fact, when she found out we were covering it, she's like, you know, we're watching that together, right? And we cuddled up in bed and watched it together. And it is a movie that is so visually arresting, so yes, of its time, and so romantic in what it is doing, even though there's so much ugliness in it. It was a zeitgeist. I mean, it really was its own thing in 1994, that there was nothing like it before or since. It would be imitated a couple of times. None of them would take. It is a movie that is very much, it is what 1994 was. It was this really interesting, to give you a sense of the time, keep in mind, 1994 is when we got Pulp Fiction.
Right.
1994 is when the indie boom really happened. There was in Hollywood, they knew independent films was the new hotness, but it hadn't quite bled out to the mainstream yet. And 94, 95 is when it exploded. 94, 95 also when grunge was at its peak. When the grunge artists went from being on the fringe to being mainstream to being fucking everything anyone was talking about or listening to. And so The Crow came out like an atom bomb of everything of outsider culture. Like it was all the goth stuff rolled up into one. It was a comic book movie. It was grunge music. It was this cutting edge director making this really weird fucking movie. It was, for hardcore cinephiles like myself, a number of your favorite character actors all together in one fucking movie. Like, you thought last week was an amazing cast with a perfect weapon for the background. There are no big name actors in this movie. It's all junk food fucking alums and some of our very favorites, all of whom we'll go through.
You gonna learn all about it.
It pressed all the buttons at once and mashed them down into one perfect film that to this day remains a perfect fucking film.
I agree. And it's funny. It's one of the rare instances where a movie is a time capsule, but somehow in revisiting it a generation later, the fact that it is a time capsule only serves to improve the revisit. It's one of those things that when you watch movies that are a snapshot of the era, sometimes it's a little hokey, sometimes a little cheesy, very dated. There's something about this movie and the vision that Proy has had that even though it is a fucking Grimrock circle jerk, like, just look at the fucking soundtrack of this movie. You want to understand the aesthetic of this movie? Look at the fucking soundtrack.
Which is one of the best soundtracks of all time.
Yeah.
Like, it is just the bands they have on this soundtrack, plus the songs that they gave them on this soundtrack, were just phenomenal. This is one of those three albums that everyone in the 90s owned. Like, if you lived in the 90s and you had your own money, you owned Lives Throwing Copper, mm-hmm, you owned Nine Inch Nails for the Downward Spiral, and you owned The Crow soundtrack. Yeah. Those were the three albums everyone fucking owned.
Yeah, and I will say the love, the capital L love for this movie only came in recent revisiting. I always liked this movie. Mm. It wasn't until a recent revisiting that I was like, you know what? this is an amazing fucking film.
Every moment of, like, I was rewatching it last night. Every moment of this film is perfect for what it's trying to do. And there's nothing, like, the things that are dated about it are only the limitations of the effects at the time.
This is true. But what I think is, what struck me upon recent revisiting is that it's a shame that what most people remember this movie for overshadows the movie itself.
Yes. And let's get into that, because the thing that happened with this movie, I think, is part of what made this movie what it is. Like, and I think that what made this movie what it is very much what made The Dark Knight what it is, in that you have this tragic final performance.
I'm just going to pause you real quick, because we're going to talk about some comparisons to this movie and The Dark Knight. Oh, don't fucking worry about it. You know what?
Before we go any further, let's mention the fact that The Crow is such a good movie. It was ripped off by a lot of your favorite movies.
Yeah.
John Wick, as we already mentioned, The Dark Knight, The Matrix, so many iconic movies borrowed from what Proyas did here. Like, so much so, the first time I saw The Matrix, for the first 15 minutes of the movie, I hated it. Because I was like, oh, so this is just The Crow. All those trailers, what is The Matrix? Oh, The Matrix is just The fucking Crow. Yes, we're running across rooftops. Relieved, but yes, I've seen this fucking movie already.
Sure.
And then it goes, then there's that moment where she jumps and kicks.
Yeah.
And we get the spin around. I'm like, wait, is this a Mage the Ascension movie? And then it turns into, like, from then on, it just keeps blowing my mind. And by the time I walked out, I was like, holy fuck, The Matrix. But, like, so many movies ripped off Alex Proyas and what he did in The Crow, because this movie, like, really landed. But in terms of the death of Brandon Lee, was very much like what happened with The Dark Knight, where it took a film that wasn't on a lot of people's radar and really put it on someone's radar. Now, it was a movie that was already on my radar. As I've talked about many times, I'm a hardcore comic nerd, you know, in my childhood particularly. And Jay Obar's The Crow is one of those perfect miniseries. Like, it is just, as a graphic novel, if you've never read it, it's actually very different from the movie. Chiefly that the entire third act of the movie is not in the comic. The death of David Patrick Kelly's character, a T-Bird, is mostly the end of The Crow.
Because in the comics, T-Bird was the big bad.
Yeah, he was the big bad. And then there's this really tragic ending in which The Crow can't die. And so he goes off and puts a gun in his mouth in the graveyard next to Shelley's grave and kills himself so that he can go be with her again. And it was one of those comics that the history of that comic, is that Jay Obar was wrestling with the death of his fiance. And that he had all this sadness and this anger that he couldn't unleash, and he couldn't get it out. And so he got it out in terms of a story, and he created The Crow and created one of the great iconic comics of the 90s in doing so. And it was such a great comic that it, of course, got picked up for adaptation, even when comic adaptations were not going. You know, we talked about how Superman was the greatest comic book adaptation until the modern era. The Crow was the second greatest. And for a lot of us, it was kind of our favorite. But a lot of people didn't really consider it a comic adaptation because it wasn't one of the main companies. But it really, you know, it was, and was such a wonderful distillation of where pop culture was at the time, in terms of, I've talked about it in the past, how in the early 80s, we kind of fell in love with anti-heroes, and The Crow was one of those great anti-heroes going in through the 90s, but also kind of captured that the obsession with darkness in the 90s.
Where, oh, for sure, yeah.
You know, where everyone just kind of, we were told all the problems were solved, but the world was still kind of a shitty place. And nobody had quite realized that the world was getting better at that point from a lot of circumstances. So we still had that feeling that the world could at any moment slip into oblivion. And this movie really fucking captured that in such an amazing fucking way.
And it's interesting to me to talk about. Now, Brandon Lee is an actor who I I am in love with because of his action work. I loved him in Showdown in Little Tokyo. I really fucking love him in a movie called Rapid Fire.
I remember when Rapid Fire came out on Blu-ray and you about pissed yourself when you found out it was coming in the next day.
Well, yeah, because when I wanted to buy it, it was out of print and I was fucking furious. But I found a way, and I have now procured a copy of Rapid Fire on Blu-ray, which is basically a buddy cop movie where the cop is Powers Booth and the martial artist is fucking Brandon Lee against the Chicago Mafia. Absolutely, I'm going to fucking love that movie.
Yeah, and the thing is, The Crow was supposed to be Brandon Lee's launching into the mainstream.
And what's insane about that to me is that this is so different from anything Brandon Lee had done. And it actually made the author of the comic book who you just mentioned,
Jay Obar.
Yeah, Jay Obar was not happy with the casting of Brandon Lee because he had only ever seen Showdown in Little Tokyo, where it's Brandon Lee and Dolph Lundgren. And having only seen that, I guess I can kind of understand his reservation, especially when they had guys like Christian Slater like passing on the role. And then deciding that they wanted actually River Phoenix and Christian Slater both passed on this role. And James Obar wanted Johnny Depp. And instead, he got Brandon Lee. But then when he came to set and saw him in the makeup and the costume and saw his take on the character, this is one of those roles that you can really feel like Brandon Lee saw the potential in this to not only flex himself as an actor, but to really disappear into a role. And that is, he gives this movie 200% of himself.
Yeah, the Brandon Lee you see in Rapid Fire and Showdown in Little Tokyo, totally different from this fucking Brandon Lee.
Absolutely.
And he's really good. In fact, there's only one scene I think he's a little shaky in. But aside from that, he is so fucking good. The scene with Fun Boy, when Fun Boy's shooting at him and he's doing the famous scene from the comics where he's telling the story of Jesus walking into an inn.
That joke is so goddamn funny. I laughed out loud. I was like, that is a funny joke.
Stop me if you heard this one. Jesus Christ walks into a hotel. He hands the innkeeper 3 nails and he asks, can you put me up for the night?
Come on, guys. And that's hilarious.
Yeah. And it's but he's so good in this role. And this movie is a movie in which has been referenced a lot to anyone who works in Hollywood. Like, this is the movie that ultimately is why, this is why you hire union. This is why you get union people on your fucking job. This is why you do things the right way. Everyone in Hollywood who is handed a gun the first time is told the story of The Crow.
Yeah.
They are told what happened to Brandon Lee, because this is here is this up and coming star, and he was killed because somebody didn't do their job properly on set. And this is why you always, always make sure you follow all the rules while handling a firearm on set, because dear God, you could murder someone in the middle of making this movie purely by accident.
And it is true that the circumstances of why that gun fired a projectile that could have killed someone, it's like the series of things. It's almost like Tony Todd was involved, and it's a Final Destination movie.
Speaking
like,
of which, Tony Todd totally
is in this movie, yes. but no, it's very Final Destination, because like this had to happen, and then this, and then this, and then this, and like it's a freak accident. However, if you had people doing their jobs, you would have accounted for the possibility of freak accidents, and it wouldn't have happened. I was on a tiny, tiny productions, like a tiny budget production here in Austin. It was actually one of Owen's movies, Owen Edgerton. And I was on that set for one day, and there was a scene involving a gun. And every 5 minutes, a different actor, a different crew member, a different anyone who was on that set asked to inspect the gun. And the person, the prop master in charge of the gun, opened it, showed them. Like, any single person on that set could ask at any time to inspect the gun.
Yeah, because those are the rules.
Because those are the rules now. And it is tragic on so many levels, but mostly tragic because you watch a movie like this and you see a performance like this from Brandon Lee, and all you can think about is what we might have gotten.
So there may be a handful of you out there that don't know the story, but essentially what happened was they were firing blanks, and the prop master, the weapon master, did not properly clear the gun. And the blanks aren't totally blank. There is something in them. Mm-hmm. and this small little bit got lodged in the barrel. And then when they reloaded it with blanks, it fired that bit from the barrel, and it fired just like a normal projectile. And when they thought they were firing a blank into Brandon Lee, they instead fired a bit of a bullet into Brandon Lee and fucking killed him right there on set.
They had one scene that required the gun to be fired at the camera. And because of the close-up of the shot, they used dummy cartridges that had real brass caps, the bullet, but no powder. And then after that ended, after they got that shot, the prop master, who was not the arms master, because he left for the day, he dry-fired the gun to get the... So in other words, they thought by dry-firing the gun after that shot, it cleared out everything from the barrel.
Nope.
It did not. And that was the sadly... And, like, what's really nuts about this, and you, I don't even know how apocryphal this is, but you hear stories about how Bruce Lee, who also died under tragic circumstances, the father of Brandon Lee, for the three of you who might not know that, apparently when Bruce Lee came out of his coma after his motorcycle accident, he made some reference to this vision that he had had that his son was going to die, like, tragically. Like, his son was... And again... Could be a completely apocryphal bullshit story, but when you start, like, digging into this family and what they went through and all of the tragedy surrounding them, it does kind of feel like this odd curse. Like, and it's so heartbreaking because I want to see more Brandon Lee. I want to see more Brandon Lee roles. Who knows what kind of movies he could have been in? And I can tell you for a fact that one of the movies definitely inspired by Brandon Lee in this movie. We've touched on it already, but Heath Ledger's Joker in The Dark Knight is so fucking inspired by Brandon Lee's The Crow. There's literally a scene in the movie where Brandon Lee goes up against Top Dollar, and Top Dollar has the little girl who has been Eric Draven's friend throughout the whole movie, and Eric Draven tells him to let her go, and he says something to the effect of, "I really wish you hadn't put it that way," and lets her go, and I'm like, that's the fucking scene from The Dark Knight with Maggie Gyllenhaal where the Joker has her and Batman says, let her go. And he goes, very poor choice of words. And then just, I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, lines of fucking dialogue are lifted entirely from The Crow for The Dark Knight.
Yep.
That's, I never
The fucking... Crow was really inspirational for a lot of folks and for a lot of films. Like, yeah. It was one of those things where it's like, how the fuck did this movie ever get made without getting fucked up by somebody? Like, it's too good of a fucking movie, and it's too cutting edge of a movie.
Yeah.
Like, it never veers back into being exactly what you think it should be. It's not... In fact, it's very weird. What I love about it, there's only one other film that we've talked about that really kind of fits the bill and isn't totally analogous, which is The Equalizer, in which the whole thing about The Crow is it's an inverted horror movie. It is a slasher movie in which you are cheering on the slasher, but you really have a good reason to cheer on the slasher.
Yeah.
These are not fucking camp counselors getting high and having sex. These are the worst of the worst in what you assume is Detroit.
It is Detroit. It is Detroit in the same way that the beginning of Demolition Man is LA. Everything is fucking on fire. Like, if you thought Action Jackson had a pessimistic view of Detroit, wait till you watch The Goddamn Crow.
Yeah. And these guys all have it coming. And you love watching them die. But the way The Crow is handled, he's a slasher killer.
Oh, absolutely.
He's a monster. He's the boogeyman. And he's the boogeyman for bad guys, which is what was so interesting about this particular take on this character in the early 90s.
Well, John wasn't exactly the boogeyman. He was the one you sent to kill the fucking boogeyman.
What's really crazy about the tragedy involving Brandon Lee is that it is one of several things that went wrong with this production from day one. Like, literally on day one in Wilmington, North Carolina, our carpenter was severely burned when his crane hit power lines. After that, a grip truck caught fire. A crew member accidentally drove a screwdriver through his hand. There was even one instance where a disgruntled sculptor on the movie crashed his car through the plaster shop. Like, this was a production that was... marred by mishaps and tragedies.
Yeah,
and
but all of those tragedies sound like non-union employees.
Right?
Like, none of that sounds like... It's not like Poltergeist, where all these horrible things befell the cast members. Yeah. It sounds like the crew didn't know what the fuck they were doing.
It definitely... Definitely sounds like someone not running that shop correctly. I will give you that entirely, and probably feeds into what happened with Brandon Lee. The movie begins, like, you want to talk about grim. The movie begins with a double murder. Like, it right out of the gate, not
of our protagonist and his girlfriend.
Yeah, our protagonist and his girlfriend, who are, as far as I can tell, living inside a Nine Inch Nails video.
Yes.
Because, like, everything... First of all, we gotta talk about the 90s aesthetic of this movie, where everything looks like it's lit by six jack-o'-lanterns on either side of the camera. Like, it's just got this flickering orange hue that is very grim 90s, like, perfectly goth. We have
Eric... In fact, we keep saying goth, but really it's goth industrial.
Yes,
absolutely. Like, it is like the...
It's goth that'll give you tetanus.
You know... The Europeans invented industrial, and we said, that's cute, and made industrial.
Again, the city is on fire at the beginning of this movie. It looks like one giant oil field.
There's actually a moment where they mention that last year was 159 fires throughout the city.
Yeah, we open on Devil's
Only
Night.
159. Only.
We open on Devil's Night, which is the night before Halloween in Detroit. Eric Draven and his girlfriend are living inside a Nine Inch Nails video.
Inside the asshole of a Nine Inch Nails video. God,
why anyone would live in this fucking place? But that's...
And not only that, the actual plot point is Shelley is fighting unnecessary eviction in the worst building in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, again, this entire building looks like it'll give you tetanus. And so she, unfortunately, like... In comes a gang led by T-Bird, played by...
David Patrick Kelly.
David Patrick Kelly.
God bless him.
He's so great. And he and his gang proceed to murder Eric Draven and throw him out of a window, and then rape and shoot Shelley, who then later dies at the hospital. We, of course, open the movie with a quote from the little girl in this film that says...
Sarah,
who says, you know, people used to believe that when someone died, a crow... carried their spirit to the afterlife, but sometimes if something really bad happens, that crow doesn't make it, etc., etc., etc. It is important to note that all the crows in this movie are actually ravens, which is why the... Well, it's not why, but it's interesting, too, that the lead character's name is Eric Draven. Like, if there was ever a more grim, dark character name...
First of all, the worst thing to ever come from the crow is every douchebag goth wannabe in the 90s and early aughts who named themselves Draven.
Oh, 1,000. Dude, do you think Hot Topic as a franchise would exist without this movie? Because I do not.
It does not. No, like the number of guys I've met that either just called themselves Draven or something Draven, like my eyes rolled to the back of my head so fast if you hooked up wires, it could power a city. Like, it is just, it's ridiculous. If you are one of those guys who did that, you should feel shame.
Should know that Robert Smith is on his way to your house to smack you and tell you to cheer the fuck up.
Dude, you're going
to
get the shit kicked out of you by Robert fucking Smith.
Think about that for a second. And if you don't know who I'm talking about, ask your goddamn parents. Don't wake at night to watch us. This leads into the resurrection of Eric Draven, and a revelation that the city is being run by a villain called Top Dollar, who, I'm going to go ahead and say it, is entirely a Highlander. Is 1,000% a Highlander.
First of all, they are not called Highlanders. He is a Highlander. They are immortals.
Immortals, fine.
Okay?
Fine.
He is an immortal, not a Highlander.
Split the immortal hair.
Secondly, whatever. He is played by Michael fucking Wincott, the man with one of the greatest voices in cinema history.
This is very true. Michael Wincott's a fucking legend.
He is a fucking legend. You guys will probably know him best as the sheriff of Nottingham's cousin in
the guy who asks why a spoon, not why not a dagger?
Why a spoon, sword? Cousin?
Because it's because, dull, you twit. It'll hurt more.
But he is also you will also know him from the really good first hour of Alien Resurrection.
You mean the first and only hour, and we do not
the first
speak
and only hour, and we do not speak of the second hour.
Yeah.
Yes, the part where it's essentially a test a balloon for Firefly, written by Joss Whedon. Yes, that part. That is, guys, if you've never watched Alien Resurrection through the lens of Firefly, watch Firefly. Go back and watch the first hour of Alien Resurrection, and Michael Wincott playing essentially the Nathan Fillion role is fucking awesome.
By the way, he's also a Junk Food alum.
Yes, he is.
Because he plays Rochefort in The Three Musketeers.
Yes, he does. No, Michael Wincott is a longtime favorite of mine. He would go on to, in fact, if I remember correctly, he would also do voices in the Halo series.
Yep. A lot of video game voice work for this guy.
Yeah, because he's got one of the greatest voices in history. Like, he's got one of those great gravelly voices that makes me and my gravelly voice feel so small and insignificant.
Yeah, you sound like Mark McKinney on Superstore next to Michael Wincott.
Well, boy, your mama must be damn proud of you.
Michael Wincott just has one of the great fucking voices, and he's so good in this. And, you know, just when
he's got a cabinet full of fucking rapiers. Like, yeah. He's a goddamn immortal.
Yeah. I think we broke her.
Oh my god. He's so like, good in this fucking
so movie. Good. Oh god. So already we've got David Patrick Kelly, not the big boss of this, because the big boss of this is Michael Wincott. Who else is in this movie, Brian?
Well, the cop investigating the case is one Ernie Hudson.
One Ernie fucking Hudson.
So in the course of the last 3 weeks, we've talked about Ernie Hudson twice. So
yeah, we have.
Yeah, we're on a bit of a Hudson-a-thon right now. I also want to just throw a
quick, are crossing the Hudson.
We are crossing them streams. I want to talk about Lawrence Mason, who plays the member of the gang named Tintin, because he is also a Junk Food alum playing
yes, he is.
Nixon in Hackers.
Yes. No, not Nixon. Lord Nikon.
Oh, excuse me. Nikon.
He is. So keep in mind that in this era, he was both Lord Nikon and Tintin.
Yes.
Pretty. In like 94, 95, like this is his heyday, and he is the only thing that pisses me off about The Crow is that Tintin is the first one to go, because of the gang, aside from David Patrick Kelly, Lord Nikon is where it's fucking at.
Dude, okay, sidebar. We've been told, or I've been told specifically by a number of junkions, that I needed to watch a movie called Shoot to Kill with Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger.
Yes.
Okay, I watched the movie. That movie literally throws two amazing character actors off a cliff in the span of about 10 seconds. And I got a very distinctive vibe like you're getting from them killing Tintin first.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, Richard Mazur and fucking Andrew, and you just threw them off the fucking cliff. We have them to spare, so we're going to throw them off a fucking cliff.
And what do we get left with? Mumbler through the rest of the fucking movie.
It's
like the guy from the gang who survives to almost the end is the most incomprehensible of the character actors.
The guy who's still left over is Clancy Brown. And Clancy Brown is great. Oh, wait, you're talking about The Crow.
Yes.
I'm still talking about Shoot to Kill. Yes. I'm still a little bitter about Shoot to Kill.
You should
You
be.
Are correct. You are correct. The last see, now I've got a bad case of this guy's speech impediment. The last guy left over from this gang is a guy named Skank. Which, by the way, also not the first time we've covered a movie with a character named Skank. Because thank you very much, The Wraith. Because that happened there too.
Yep.
But then we have a greasy pawn shop owner played by the great John Polito.
Yep.
This movie has so many great character actors. They've got one of the stable of actors from the Coen Brothers catalog just running a pawn shop. And then from there we have, as we mentioned already, Tony Todd.
Tony Todd is one of the henchmen in this movie, because it was just very early Tony Todd, and he's so slick in this movie.
He's so fucking slick, and the thing is, he's not a part of T-Bird's gang. He's not really one of Top Dollar's henchman. He's a fucking independent. This movie has so many character actors that Tony Todd is an independent contractor in the cast. He's like called in to deal with the problem after the fact.
And then we've got Bai Ling.
Bai Ling?
Bai Ling, who would, you know, this is very early in Bai Ling. She would go on to do a lot of, like, direct-to-video stuff and a lot of action stuff over the next decade after this. It's absurd.
It's so absurd that I'm going to, okay, so Ernie Hudson, one of the things about his character is he used to be a detective, and because he kept getting in the way and kept asking questions and kept rubbing people the wrong way, he got bumped down to beat cop. Do you know who the detective is that keeps reminding him of that?
Who is the detective?
The detective who keeps reminding him of that is played by Marco Rodriguez, who's the fucking grocery store robber at the beginning of Cobra. Like, that's how fucking stacked this movie is. For God's sake, the fucking guy at the beginning of Cobra that fucking Marion Cobretti says, like, you're a lousy shot. I don't like lousy shots.
So you mean not Robert Davi, right?
Kmart Robert Davi.
Kmart Robert Davi.
Yes, absolutely.
Like, I'm watching this going, this is a Robert Davi role that Robert Davi turned down.
He's a Demi Davi. Let's get it
the
straight.
Demi Davi?
He's a Demi Davi.
The Demi Lovato Davi?
Ask your children? Demi Lovato references. I gotta give props for that.
Demi Lovato is...
Young like, man Cargill stepping up over like, here.
First hit was like over a decade and a half ago.
I don't even know who
you're
that
not
is
that
enough
young.
To, I don't even know who that is enough to give you props on it. So
Domo Arigato, right. Demi Lovato, Domo
why?
Domo.
Why?
Domo Domo.
Why? this is happening for real.
This
in
is happening.
Episode.
Like, there's Demi Lovato jokes coming out, and you have no idea who she is.
So the other thing that's changed from comic to film adaptation is that Eric Draven has this like crow analog, like a literal bird that represents his life and his soul, and the bird like tracks people.
Well,
for
the
him
bird, the crow is in the comic, but not in the way that it is.
Yeah, it wasn't
in the third
connected
act.
To his life force.
Yeah, because yeah, in the third act, the they're trying to figure out we need to, you know, it can't. Because the thing is with the comic was, I want to say it was originally 5 issues, reprinted as 3. I think that's how it was released. And then they put it out as a graphic novel. And this is the era. What you have to keep in mind of the early 90s is this is where graphic novels first really started to happen, mm-hmm. and they weren't a common thing. It was not like it is now where every major comic collects 6 to 12 issues together in a right. graphic novel. It was rare that anything got a graphic novel, and when it did, it wasn't really – it was looked down upon, and The Crow is really that first graphic novel that we all owned. Like, it was one of those things, like I talked about earlier, with the 3 soundtracks or the 3 albums everyone owned in the 90s. If you owned a graphic novel in the 90s, it was The Crow. And if you owned 2, it was a Sandman graphic novel. Like, that's just, that's the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so everybody had it. But yeah, but it's not structured in 3 acts the way a lot of stories are. And that's one of the things. Everyone who knows Jay Obar and talks about Jay Obar as being a comic legend knows that Jay Obar is known pretty much for this. If you read any of Jay Obar's other stuff, it was good, but he never wrote anything again like The Crow. He never really managed to do something that profound. But then again, to write one comic story that was an independent comic mm-hmm. that everybody had fucking read or knew about in the 90s was a huge fucking deal. And so it was, it's really kind of hard to bust him for that. But so there's only a 2-act structure in this comic.
You kill Eric Draven. Eric Draven comes back for revenge.
And kills several other people while kind of getting all of his affairs in order. And then he kills T-Bird. And then he goes to the graveyard, sits next to Shelley's grave, puts a gun in his mouth, blows his head off, and then it cuts to an angel covering it, one of the statues of the angels covering its face, and that's the end of the fucking comic.
Which, in the movie, is him going back to the cemetery to be at Shelley's grave, but then Sarah gets kidnapped by Top Dollar and pulls him into the church.
So they add a whole third act, which is such a 90s third act. But in a really cool way, like there's like a 2-minute sequence where this becomes a buddy cop movie
with him and Ernie Hudson
and Jason Lee and Ernie Hudson as buddy cops, where one of them is supernatural.
Brandon Lee
is, yeah,
Jason Lee in this movie would just be making snarky comments about about the thing's penis. So
Brandon Lee.
Yes.
So Brandon Lee and Ernie Hudson.
That sounds like it should be an adverb.
Brandon Lee and Ernie Kovacs. So there, it's a
ask
buddy.
Your grandparents. Who Ernie Kovacs is. Wow. Do you have any other like legends of classic TV who Jeff Goldblum has played in a TV movie that you want to bust out or no?
Okay. I love that you know that.
It's something I shouldn't know at 34, so of course I know.
But it was talked about on Twitter this week, so there it is.
No, I've gone, dude, you think I haven't fallen down the Jeff Goldblum rabbit hole? Also, do you think I don't know who Ernie Kovacs is?
No, I'm thought 34 you would
going
know.
On 80.
I thought you would know. I just didn't think anyone else. So,
any Phil Silvers references you want to bust out while we're hitting this shit?
I'm feeling very F Troop tonight. So,
the end of the Civil War was near when quiet accidentally. Do you want to fucking do this? Because I'll do this all goddamn day.
Do it all goddamn day.
I am the Nick at Night generation.
You guys have all watched The Crow. Why do we need to talk about it?
No, but you're right. It does become a weird buddy cop movie where Ernie Hudson's just shooting everybody. And I love, there's something like. For a fucking second, this movie becomes Rapid Fire, becomes Showdown in Little Tokyo. When the crow realizes that all of a sudden he can get shot, it's hilarious.
I thought you were supposed to be indestructible.
I was.
I was, but not anymore.
But not anymore. The part where he goes up to Top Dollar and he's still talking smack, he's fucking quoting Poe and doing all the shit he's been doing, and then he gets shot and it hurts and he goes, oh, fuck. It's like, you can't even shoot. Oh, God. Oh, fuck. Like, it's the most hilarious. I don't even know if it's supposed to be funny, but it works because
it is.
He's just like, holy shit. Oh, like, he drops the facade immediately of being this grim, dark, like, super lord hero and just like, oh, shit, I'm a human again. This fucking hurts.
Yeah.
And it works. It works so well.
That's the thing is this movie really. It's so good at doing everything it needs to do. And then it gets to a point where they created this whole new element to this story and it all works.
Yeah.
And it adds a level of tragedy to it. That's what's so weird is that the comic and the movie deviate and you can't say one is better than the other.
Yeah.
Even though the movie is not the comic in its entirety. It does something on its own that the tragedy of the way the crow, you know, the way Eric Draven crawls to Shelley's grave and lies up against it. And we get this moment in the afterlife where she comes to him, whether it's just him dying or whether it's them being together in the afterlife, which is how I choose to interpret
I like
it,
that interpretation, yeah.
Is so profoundly beautiful. And it's weird because it's one of those, that we haven't said these words yet, but you know, we're huge revenge movie fans.
1000%.
And this is pure revenge movie.
Yeah.
And it's revenge movie in a way that we've not really quite seen before at this point, which is revenge from beyond the grave, but revenge in a way that is very human beyond the grave, where he doesn't even fully understand it. And he's trying to come to grips and settle his affairs to a certain extent.
Right. Because like you said, most of the time when we watch revenge movies from beyond the grave, it's a slasher, and it's a slasher in the effect that you maybe root, but the slasher has no personality. The slasher has no personage. The slasher is faceless.
Like the movie that we referenced earlier that probably was a much larger influence than J.R. Barr will ever acknowledge, which is The Wraith.
Yes.
Which we covered years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Please go back and revisit that episode if you haven't.
Is called Killer Cars from Interstates.
Okay.
Because dude, this is the funny part is there are still people to the sidebar. There's still people to this day who say, like, you guys should cover this movie. And I'm like, oh, we have. Where? I can't find it. Yeah, because in the early days of junk food cinema, I thought it was a good idea to make all of the titles puns. If you can believe that. So there were a lot of episodes that if you just looked at the title, you might not know that Step by Step is our episode on The Stepfather. Or you might not know that Snakes Alive is our episode on Escape from New York. Or you might not know that Killer Cars from Interstates is our movie about... Well, that's a movie about killer car movies, so I feel like you might... get a sense. But it's a bygone relic of junk food cinema that I used to give every movie or every episode a pun title. I don't do that anymore because I want you to be able to fucking find them.
Yeah.
As it turns out. Simplicity's
nice. But yeah, like that. The Wraith is, you know, there's no personality to the Wraith. Like we ultimately understand what kind of revenge it is by the end of the movie, but it is not. It's not like this where it is a deeply human revenge, and it's a revenge knowing that there is no life for you after. Yeah. Like that's what's interesting about Eric Draven is that he's coming back from the dead only for this. Like, he is not getting a second chance at life. That's never what he's back for. He doesn't want more life. Like, I want more life, fucker. Like, it's not, he's like, no, I want to get revenge for what you did to Shelley. Not even for what you did to him.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's so cool about The Crow.
Absolutely.
And that's what's so tragic about The Crow. It's why it was so romantic of a revenge, like, it's a romantic fucking revenge film. Why? Yeah. Because he doesn't care what happened to him. That's not what's important. It's not important that he was on the verge of becoming a rock star, that he had this life that could have, like, gone on. None of that matters. What matters to him is what happens to this little girl, Sarah, who he and his fiance were taking care of, and the fact that these guys did this to the one person he fucking loved.
Yeah.
And those people are going to pay because they are vile and evil. Another thing to mention that we haven't talked about yet, the Crow stands alongside the Highlander, in which it has the Highlander rule attached to it, as in there should be only one.
Yeah. When I made the reference to Top Dollar being a Highlander or being an immortal, it wasn't just because of his closet full of swords. It was because you literally have two people moving toward each other, and you know it's getting in a sword fight and somebody's getting decapitated. There is this idea that they can't both exist in this universe.
Oh, I was referring to the fact that there's three other Crow movies and all of them are terrible.
Oh, so true.
Unspeakably terrible. Like, the only thing worth mentioning about the rest of the Crow series after this is that the soundtrack for The Crow 2 is actually really fucking great.
So you don't advocate for The Crow City of Angels. You don't recommend The Crow Salvation. You're not a proponent of The Crow Wicked Prayer.
None of the above.
So The Crow Salvation is somewhat famous for the fact that it has Kirsten Dunst.
Yep, that was the only thing it was known for when it came out, too.
Is the person who is the Crow not Eric Draven in the other sequels? Because I don't see his name
in
the cast. So it's
it was the interesting concept of what they did. Like, what they did was cool. Was, you know, Eric Draven's dead. He got his revenge. He went back. And then the Crow ferries other people who have been wronged. But none of those movies are good. The Crow City of Angels has really... Because The Crow was such a big deal, they were able to get a lot of good cameos and a great cast for the sequel, but it's not a good fucking movie.
I'm going to point out, just very quickly, that The Crow Wicked Prayer,
which
stars Edward Furlong as The Crow, because your guess...
Check out who the director is on that one. Your guess
is as good as Lance Muniga?
Yeah, look up his filmography real quick.
Six Ring Samurai. Oh.
Yeah. Oh, a movie boy. We will cover at some point.
A movie that was actually one of my taste test challenges recently. It was over a year ago, but I really enjoyed
Dude,
it.
Dude, I had no idea. I've been meaning to cover Six String Samurai forever.
We will on this.
Because sure. I love Six String Samurai, but like that was a big deal. Like it was one of those things where I remember that was something me and Harry Knowles kind of had a weird stare down over because... that Wicked Prayer was coming out and I rolled my eyes and I'm like, yeah, because there's ever going to be another good Crow movie because that's one of the rules. None of them are good beyond the first. And he's like, no, it was actually the guy who did Six Ring Samurai. So you're full of shit. That movie's going to be fucking great. And then the movie came out and it wasn't.
But it does. I just want to, this fucking cast in that particular Crow sequel.
Yeah.
It's not that it's amazing, it's that it's fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be. For example, Dennis Hopper and Macy Gray are in the same movie.
Yep.
Let's just fucking start there and work our way forward.
Oh, dude, all the Crow movies are like this. Let's go through the cast of each Crow movie. Like,
okay, but let's do
Wicked Prayer.
Stick with Wicked Prayer. We've got Danny Trejo, because Danny Trejo is omnipresent. David Boreanaz and Tara Reid.
Yep.
David Boreanaz and Tara Reid.
Oh, I've seen
Tito
all of
these. Ortiz.
You, none of this is going to shock me.
No, I'm not. This is not for you. This is for people who don't know this, listening to this. But again, Edward Furlong. But yeah, let's go ahead and just start with City of Angels, which was the 1996 sequel.
Yep.
That starred Vincent Perez as Ash Corvin.
Yep.
Slash the Crow. That also has
Corvin being another word for crows.
Get it? Which also has Iggy Pop, Thomas Jane.
I'm telling you,
Thomas fucking Jane.
Keep going.
That is fucking Thomas Jane is in that fucking movie.
I love how you freak out over Thomas Jane and not Iggy Pop.
Well, again, great point. The Crow Salvation, which is the next movie, has Kirsten Dunst, as we mentioned, the great William Atherton. Who most people know is the guy who shut down the containment unit in Ghostbusters, and he should not have done that. Walton Goggins? Walton Goggins? Fred Ward?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
The casts of all of the Crow films are amazing and all Junk Food alums. None of the movies beyond the first. The first one is perfection, and everything beyond that is unwatchable.
Holy shit, you guys. So the Crow 2019, which is listed in IMDb, says, this is the plot synopsis, a year after he and his fiance are murdered, Eric is brought back to life by Miss. So it's a straight up remake.
Yeah, they've been talking about remaking.
It's not a sequel. It's a
I don't understand
remake.
Why you'd remake The Crow. Like, The Crow is one of those movies that
it's
even
a product
watching
of
it,
its time.
Like, it's the thing is, it's not just a product of the time. It's a perfect movie of its time.
Agreed.
It is a movie that just like hit all the points. And okay, so let's talk about the only flaws of this movie. Because the only real flaws of The Crow are the scenes they had not shot yet.
Four of them.
Some of them.
There were only four scenes.
Yes, but some of those scenes work because what they do is they have a double in shadow. Totally works. There are two shots that are digitally constructed. At the time, this was a big deal because they had not done facial replacement yet in movies like this. And they did it. And at the time, we were like, wow.
Yeah.
Holy, what scenes were replaced? We didn't know. And now, you know, watching it fucking 25 years later, it's like, oh, it was this scene and this scene. Like, you can just see the digital stutter. You can see the imperfections in it. But even then, like, it was really great how in one of the scenes, how David Proyas, who we'll get to in a second,
Alex Proyas.
I don't know how we got this far without really talking about Proyas. We mentioned him in passing. One of those scenes he did where he used the cracks of a broken mirror to hide the digital effect, which was a really smart move. But the other shot, you can just see this weird stutter to it. But it is so well done. And so expertly executed in the other bits of the replacement scenes that it's amazing that they were able to finish that. And of course, we would see that happen again about 20 years later with, you know, Fast and the Furious 7.
Yeah.
In which they would do something very similar using
his brother, Paul Walker's brother.
Yeah, Paul Walker's brother, and then using digital facial replacement.
And I have to say, at no point during that movie did I ever see a seam. Like, that's, you know, say what you want about the Fast and the Furious movies, but when they were presented with the same challenge, because I was looking for it.
Yeah.
Because I obviously follow this franchise very closely. I could not see a single fucking seam of their digital replacement of how they had to get around the fact that Paul Walker had died. And I actually didn't know this until recently, that when Brandon Lee was killed, They only had four more scenes to shoot.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I had got it in my head that there was a lot more to this movie that was unfinished, but apparently the majority of the movie and...
No, they decided for some reason to shoot the death sequences, the whole thing that essentially takes place before the movie starts, at the end of the movie.
So
and
crazy.
Thankfully, that's where that happened. I mean, maybe not thankfully. Maybe if they had shot it early on,
who knows?
Guy wouldn't have been tired and gone home early.
Well,
and
there's also the fact that it was the scene where Funboy shoots Eric Draven. That is the scene they were filming when Brandon Lee was killed. He wasn't originally in the script supposed to fire a gun at him. That was something Proyas changed at the last minute. Like, there are so many weird things that if one thing had been different, we still would have had Brandon Lee in movies to this day.
Yeah.
And so it's completely insane to me. But yeah, there were only four scenes. And there is a weird sort of character shorthand that feels like bad editing until you know the story of this movie. The scene where he comes out of the grave, and then it immediately smash cuts to him in an alley, and then immediately smash cuts to him back in that apartment. If you don't know the history of this movie, you're probably sitting there like, this is bad editing. This is so, like, staccato. Like, what is going on here? And then you realize that they are trying to string things together without ever showing his face.
Because he wasn't alive.
Because he wasn't there. And it's amazing now to watch knowing that and see how they kind of worked around that. And then on top of that, we get all these amazing... Watching Eric Draven devour this... Like, watching Brandon Lee... like dip the scenery in peanut butter and just chew it up as he is exacting his revenge is my favorite part of this movie. Like there's a great moment where he stabs Tintin to death like 40 times and David Patrick Kelly goes to Top Dollar and he's like, yeah, he stabbed him in all of his organs in alphabetical order. Like it's such a great fucking line because when you see Tintin sitting there, he's got like 40 fucking knives like surrounding a single spot in his body. It's incredible. Like, and then he breaks it, like, when he goes into Top Dollar's lair, like, he's in Punisher Warzone and just lays waste to the whole room.
Or where Punisher Warzone rips off.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
The Crow?
Yeah. It was, all we were missing was him hanging from the chandelier and shooting people in a circle.
Yeah, no, it's like, that was one of the other movies I meant to mention earlier, was Punisher Warzone. That so clearly takes from The Crow liberally.
Yeah. I feel like every filmic interpretation of The Punisher since The Crow is The Crow. Like, is trying to be The Crow, right down to the grease paint skull on the shirt. Which, by the way, apparently that was one of the things that Brandon Lee was very unhappy with originally, was the makeup. He didn't like the way it looked. He thought it looked too false. So him and Alex Proyas worked out this arrangement where he would do his own makeup at night, sleep with it on, and then wake up the next day and they would just shoot whatever he woke up with. And I'm like, how does that not remind you of exactly the aesthetic of Heath Ledger's Joker makeup? That feels like the Joker just went to sleep with grease on his face and woke up like that.
Yeah.
I woke up like this, which is the second week in a row that we're saying that. But it's really amazing how great, like, the makeup doesn't hide Brandon Lee's face. It doesn't feel like he is performing through it. The costume is like mostly duct tape and Hot Topic clothes. Like he makes it fucking work in a way that you love and becomes so iconic, every element of this character. And I totally, totally get why this is one of the benchmark movies of this decade.
Yeah, it was an unreal movie to see unfold. In fact, it was one of those things where as a result of it, it was one of those, almost everyone I knew at some point was dating someone where they gave them The Crow, graphic novel.
Oh, this graphic novel.
Yeah. Like it was just one of those, it was who I hung with. And that was the time. It was a movie that really kind of hit us in a way we had not seen a film like that. I wanted to talk for a moment about Eric Proyas,
Alex Proyas.
I keep saying that. Alex Proyas. For fuck's sake, there is no Eric Proyas. Out there, somebody's listening going, I'm Eric Proyas, Cargill, fuck you.
Canceling my Patreon right now.
Alex Proyas. This is part of his run in the 90s where he was the guy. Like, everybody got really excited about him. And then he kind of started falling off. But I'm curious what you think, Brian, because we've never talked about it. If you had to choose one movie that could still stay in existence, would you take The Crow or would you take Dark City?
The Crow. Like, it's not even... You have to... I mean, remember this about me. How obsessed with 90s superheroes I am. How that was my bread and butter. How I love The Shadow, The Phantom, The Crow, Dick Tracy. Like, there's not a single... except for Spawn, like superhero movie in the 90s that I don't glom onto and go, I fucking love
everything. No. I think you're lying right now.
Like, okay, which one am I forgetting?
Steel.
I'll watch Steel all day. Are you kidding me?
Really?
With
The Shack?
Okay, don't get me wrong.
The Shack?
The Shack, by the way.
Who has the cancer and is on the weed?
I was gonna... I was going to say The Shack, that terrible Christian movie from a couple years ago. No, here's why. Because it's terrible. I'm not saying it's a good movie. I am saying it's a great movie. I love Judd Nelson in that movie as this weird, yuppie fucking arms dealer.
Oh, God, I forgot Judd Nelson in Steel.
Dude,
fuck.
And fucking, like, there's so many things about that movie that don't work in a way that delights me. Nothing about Spawn delights me at all. I think that movie is, like, too grimdark. Like, it takes the crow and it's like, we're going to be dark. And I'm like, you shouldn't. You really shouldn't. Even though it's got actors in it, like Michael Jai White and Martin Sheen, that I fucking love, it just, nothing about that movie comes together to be entertaining. Every other fucking superhero movie in the 90s, like, I am on board. I am here for it. So, in the question, which movie do I keep, Dark City or The Crow? The answer is The Crow.
Right on.
Well, and the answer is The Crow also, because if you take The Crow out of existence, there's basically two Brandon Lee movies, and that bothers me. It bothers me that there's really to speak of. Like, there is
to
one...
To speak of?
Yeah. There is one other Brandon Lee movie that I think is called, like, Laser Mission that I've never seen.
Because it's called Laser Mission.
It's called Laser Mission. But, like, Rapid Fire, Showdown in Little Tokyo, and The Crow, I'm like, that's a fucking triple feature that I will revisit every year. Not only that, I've decided that this movie is going to make it into my Halloween rotation every year. And I don't know why.
Oh, night before Halloween.
I don't know why I haven't been doing that
in the 90s. In the 90s, there were a bunch of indie theaters that would show The Crow on Devil's Night, and they would have Devil Night screenings.
As well, they fucking should have.
You know what they got now? Devil's Night greeting cards. Isn't that precious?
Also, I loved what you said about how he's getting revenge not for his own murder, but for Shelley's, because that's so fucking true. There's a great line of dialogue where one of the bad guys says to him, you're the guy that murdered Tintin. And his response is, he was already dead. He died a year ago the moment he touched her.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah.
Talk about romantic revenge films. Like, it doesn't get more romantic than that. Also, I love the fact that one of the Crow's side missions in this movie is that he helps a woman be a better mom. Like, yeah. He uses violence to help a woman be a better mom. And it kind of works. And I'm not complaining about it. Like, it should take me out of the movie entirely. It does not.
No, it's not about making her a better mom. It's about making sure that Sarah's taken care of, because Sarah is what Shelley cared for. Like, right. Shelley loved Sarah. And as a result, Eric loves Sarah. And someone needs to take care of Sarah. And so if he's got to scare her mom back into fucking taking care of her, because she needs someone in her life, because otherwise she's just going to be a mess. And like, the only thing she's got in her life is this fuck up of a cop who we barely talked about. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, he's one of those cops that you kind of feel for and you're like, no, he's the good cop. He really knows what's going on. No, he's a fuck up. Like, everything he does in this movie is wrong.
Are we talking about Ernie Hudson?
Ernie Hudson.
Yeah.
Everything he does is wrong as a cop. Like, he is never doing what he should be doing.
Right down to the fact that his apartment is dressed by the same person who finds shit for TGI Fridays. Did you notice this? He's got a fucking basketball and a trombone just sitting on his couch.
I did not notice that.
And I'm
that.
Like, if there's an old-timey bowling pin on that bookshelf, I'm calling bullshit. Oh. What is the deal with this TGI Fridays set dressing in Ernie Hudson's apartment? Also, I love that he's just wearing... He's got an undershirt.
He's like, well, he's a black detective, so he should be like he's a character out of Mo Better Blues.
Mo Better Blue Cheese dressing for your wings here at TGI Fridays?
Yeah, that's a little... Like, I've never noticed the basketball and the trombone.
They're on the same couch! Like, they're occupying 66% of the sitting real estate in his apartment.
Except that I'm always paying attention to Ernie Hudson in that white t-shirt and his gut, like, hanging out.
And the boxer shorts and his hat on like he's fucking Ralph Cramden.
Yeah.
Ask your goddamn grandparents why. And then fucking Draven has to come in and be like, you're still wearing your hat.
It's why I've never noticed the basketball and the trombone. Swear to God, I've seen that movie a billion times, never noticed.
It's so fucking weird. I couldn't stop looking at it. I was like, is anyone going to address the trombone and the basket? No, we're just going to leave it there. Okay, today's special is French onion soup, evidently. What is happening right now? Would you like some fried mac and cheese? Yes, you would, because you live inside of fucking TGI Fridays in the center of the earth where everything is on fire, also known as Detroit.
I think that's what they would call flair.
Eric Draven would be the worst TGI Fridays waiter. Like, his suspenders would be black. All of his buttons would be black. It would all be like Nine Inch Nails and The Cure and fucking the Rollins Band buttons on his fucking
suspenders. I'd like to order some fried cheese sticks. You already ordered the fried cheese sticks. You ordered the fried cheese sticks the minute you touched her.
What does that... Does that mean they're out of them? I don't... Do you want to order something? I don't know what's going on. Hey, the Southwestern egg rolls. Can we order those? Sure. You're dead already. What? I don't understand what's happening. Should we go to Flingers? I don't... What's happening right now?
I think it's time for the junk food pairing.
I think it's entirely the time for the junk food pairing.
I think there's really only one junk food pairing.
You say that? Movie. You say that, but I'm going to throw one out that I don't... know that we're on the same page, and you're going to hate it initially, but stick with me on this.
I think that's like every week.
Yeah. Bullet bourbon. Do a shot of bullet bourbon.
Okay.
When you watch this movie, because there's...
That's... You know what? I think that's brilliant. I don't hate that. Like, that's great. That is such a great tie-in of doing a shot of whiskey and swallowing a bullet.
Which, like, I'm pretty sure even Nicolas Cage in Lord of War would be like, that's a bit extreme. Because there's literally a scene where David Patrick Kelly and his gang are... swallowing a bullet and chasing it with a shot of whiskey.
And trying to be more extreme than the guy before them.
Yeah.
Like, that's the game they're playing.
It's kind of fucking nuts.
Yeah, no, that's much better than a hot dog with onions.
Or no onions,
because they make you fart.
They make you fart big time. Which is, I knew that's where you were going.
Yeah, because it's, like, obvious. It's like, have a hot dog and watch The Crow. But, no, I like bullet bourbon much better. I think you did much better than I did this time.
Wow. There, like, you go.
I said that out loud.
Put that on the calendar.
Like, I didn't just think that. I said it out loud. Fire it up! Fire it up!
Guys, thank you so much for joining us. And in particular, last week we talked about Jeff Speakman. This week we're going to talk about Jeff Hunter, who is the patron who requested that we cover The Crow. So thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Great choice.
Yeah, and I'm so excited we got to talk about it. I fucking love this movie. It's a movie that every time I revisit it, I love it more, and I've reached the point now where I'm just full-on fucking in love with this movie, like head over heels.
It just makes me sad that there was a time in your life where you just liked it. Like,
I never disliked it. I want to point that out.
No, I'm not saying that, but, like, I can't imagine only liking The Crow. Like, The Crow is one of those, I had to pick 10 movies to walk away from the 90s with and wipe away the rest of it, it would clearly be on the list.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Without a doubt.
Oh, I get that. I totally get that. But that is also the line of demarcation with the age difference between us, I think, is in 1994, I was 10 years old. So there's a lot of movies in 1994 that...
Just to give you guys an idea, let me just name three other films that came out at roughly the same time as The Crow. Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
The Shawshank Redemption.
Heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, and Forrest Gump.
Yeah, a little indie film called Forrest Gump.
Like, and then there, you know what? I'll mention a fifth one because there's a little Tim Burton movie called Ed Wood. Like, 1994 was such an explosive year for, oh my God, film is so fucking weird and cool.
Yeah,
it is the best year of the 90s by far. Followed only, arguably, either by 97 or 99, depending on who you are and how old you are.
Do you think Ed Wood is the only reason Tim Burton didn't get offered this movie? Because this feels like a movie they definitely would have thrown at Tim Burton.
No, because I think Tim Burton was in a very weird place after the Batman movies, and I think that they were trying to avoid that with this movie. Also, they couldn't afford to, Tim Burton at this point.
Well, they thought they could afford Johnny Depp. They thought they could.
Oh, whoa. Johnny Depp 94 was not a big star. Keep that in mind. Johnny Depp was a guy doing fucking weird-ass indie films after he was a big TV star.
Including Ed Wood.
Yes. At this point, he was, like, he had done Edward Scissorhands, but he was just doing weird shit at that point. Like, he was not a big star, and in fact, it wouldn't be until a few years later that he would start doing more mainstream stuff because he'd had kids, and we all kind of looked the other way. It was one of those weird things. Like, he would do stuff like The Astronaut's Wife. And we'd be like, oh, yeah, he just had kids. You know what? I'm paying for my kids movie.
Do you know who looked the other way with The Astronaut's Wife? Most audiences. didn't fucking watch that movie. I
saw it in a theater.
Oh, Cargill. That's too bad.
I like Johnny Depp. My wife really liked Johnny Depp.
I mean, that you said liked. I like that there was a past tense.
If you've not read the Rolling Stone piece on Johnny Depp, it's kind of one of the most enlightening and sad things. Like, I mean, this is a hell of a sidebar. But Johnny Depp is one of those guys who's...
Oh, it's a sidebar? Let me drink some bullet bourbon real quick.
Yeah.
Oh, there was a real bullet in that. God damn it. All right.
Yeah, no, Johnny Depp had two heroes who he spent a lot of time with, both of whom have really, really sad third acts to their life. One is Hunter S. Thompson, and of course the other is Marlon Brando. And he... has followed them down the rabbit hole, and like, I don't know if it's him looking up to them or him just not paying attention, but that Rolling Stone piece of this sad kind of lonely guy drinking himself to death on, you know, $30,000 of wine a month is one of the most depressing looks at one of the great talents of his generation. And like, had he been in this movie, I think there'd be a certain kind of tragedy, beautiful tragedy to it. Instead, we got the great Brandon Lee movie and the last Brandon Lee movie. And it's weird to think that when all is said and done, Brandon Lee might have gotten the better death.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's...
So good night, everybody! Well, setting you off on that happy note.
Let's bring this full circle, because to quote The Dark Knight, you either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become Johnny Depp. So there is that for sure. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Cringing after that conversation. Why did we go down that rabbit hole? You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MassAwirm, MassAwirm. And you can find me and along with Dave Chen on my weekly writing podcast, Write Along Podcast, which you can find at Write Along on Twitter.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Twitter at JunkFoodCinema. And I got to say, guys, the interactions I've had lately with Junkions just on random Friday and Saturday nights, just talking about what movies you're watching, have been amazing. Y'all convinced me to watch Drive from 1997 starring Mark Dacascos, which will go down as one of my favorite film discoveries of this year and be an episode on
this show. It's only January. You've had two favorite film discoveries of the year.
Oh, yeah. Dude, it's been an amazing, very productive January in that regard. I finally saw Robert Altman's Popeye for the first time. I'd never seen it all the way through, and I was not expecting that movie to be such an emotional gut punch. Like, I was expecting great production design. I was expecting a great performance from Robin Williams. I was not expecting it to emotionally resonate with me on a level I had no idea that Popeye could ever do. Like, it was incredible. So, yeah. January's been an amazing month for film discoveries, so I owe a lot of that to you guys. I owe also a lot of it to 80s All Over. So stop me if you've heard this one. JFC walks into an inn and hands the innkeeper three nails and says,
hands him three beers.
Can you put me up for the night? Did that work?
No.
Didn't work.